host and various guests and may not reflect the views of WHRW's management or of other WHRW station members. This program may contain frank language and or material. Therefore, we advise you to carefully consider whether you or your children should listen.
Welcome, kind listeners. This is Binghamton WHRW 90.5 FM. I'm your host, Tarek Abdelazim, and this is Civil Discourse. There will be no extended introduction this week. It's far more important to allocate every possible minute we have here to my in-studio guest this afternoon, Sergeant Jimmy Massey. Jimmy Massey's former Marine Staff Sergeant was honorably discharged in December 2003 after having served 12 years. Massey not only partook in the initial invasion of Iraq in March of 2003, but was also a boot camp instructor for almost 3 years and a military recruiter for the Marine Corps for 3 years. He is not your stereotypical anti-war activist, but he signifies the growing white alliance of citizens, veterans, and soldiers who refuse to accept silently the war policies of this administration and their social, political, and human costs. Today's interview is just one of several events Massey has scheduled here in Binghamton. Earlier, he was at a breakfast talk at St. Paul's Lutheran Church. At 2 p.m., he participated in a debate with a current military recruiter at Broome Community College. And later this evening, at 7 p.m., Massey will give a final talk at Binghamton University in Lecture Hall 1. His talks in Binghamton are part of a much larger upstate New York tour, and I'd like to personally commend Massey for his tireless efforts to share with others his story. And it truly is my honor to welcome you to today's show. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
One, I would like to just inform our guests that if we have time at the end of the show for 5 to 8 minutes, we'll probably field some phone calls. And you can call in at 607-777-2137. We're just going to get directly into some of the questions. Your service in Iraq began exactly when?
I was deployed in theater in Kuwait January of 2003. We actually LD'd, or line of departure, as the Marine Corps called it, around March 22nd of 2003. So I was actually in country March 22nd.
Okay, and you stayed there until your discharge, honorable discharge, which was December?
No, my honorable discharge was December 31st of 2003. I was honorably discharged. I was medevaced out of Iraq May 15th of 2003 with post-traumatic stress disorder and major depression.
Okay, so that was then just a couple months in Iraq.
Correct, yes.
Let's then follow it from the beginning. When you first went over there, did you find that what you were doing, as explained by the president, was a just cause?
I don't feel it was. The weapons of mass destruction, we searched high and low, found no weapons of mass destruction, and that was our total basis for going into the country and going into to war. It was false. It was false information, and the continued intelligence reports that were manifested in Iraq that's continuing escalating the violence in the war right now. So it's a continued interpretation of misleading intelligence reports that's still are continuing to cause the rise of insurgency in Iraq right now.
And this has been unfolding, I think, with great detail. And in all the reports, it says, you know, we've had it all wrong, was a comment that David Kaye made. But I want to return again. When you first were deployed there, did you feel that you were there for purposeful reasons? Granted, perhaps later we had questions about weapons of mass destruction, but initially, you and perhaps even your colleagues, your fellow soldiers.
Yeah, I was just like everybody else. I knew Saddam Hussein was definitely an evil dictator and needed to be taken out, and punished in a world court. That's how I feel Saddam Hussein should be dealt with, in a world court, in front of the global community. So, but it the.
So then perhaps your experience is this is what led you, this is your impression as you began your deployment.
Yes.
What happened over there in those 2 months in which you started to, one, question the mission in Iraq, and two, your, you know, personal involvement?
The course came for me, which changed my mind on how I felt about the war. There was an incident that I called a Red Kia incident where this vehicle sped into our checkpoint, and we discharged our weapons into the vehicle. We gave hand and arm signals and a warning shot trying to get the vehicle to stop to no prevail. Three of the occupants of the vehicle were seriously wounded and expiring fast. The driver of the vehicle was miraculously unscathed, and the horrifying moment that really sticks out in my mind, though, where I continue to have flashbacks or reoccurring nightmares, is this young man asking me, "Why did you kill my brother?" And you know, what do you say? I mean, how do you react to that? And this is haunting memories that I have every day for this young man asking me a simple question: "Why did you kill my brother?"
Mm-hmm. But that seems like it was a very pivotal, unfortunate event. Was that the only incident that you had that you found troubling?
No, over a course of a 48-hour period, we killed 30-plus innocent civilians.
When you say we?
We, meaning 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines. I was with 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines, stationed out of 29 Palms, California, with a weapons company, CAT, Combined Anti-Armor Team 1, which consisted of machine gunners, missile men, and scout snipers.
And was this out on patrol? Were you checkpoints? What exactly was your role there?
What we were primarily there for was checkpoints. And this was during the first 48 hours, the battle for Baghdad, during that first 48 hours.
Mm-hmm. When you went to Iraq, what was your impression of the Iraqi people? You know, from one side of the TV screen, it became such a spectacle almost that there was going to be this massive confrontation, video pyrotechnics. What did you experience on the ground?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. That was brought up during the recruiter at the last event. But I experienced nothing but generosity. The Iraqis were coming out and bringing us flowers. They were bringing us food, bringing us tea. So I didn't, as a matter of fact, the entire time on the way up to Baghdad, I was only fired at once. You know, it was a pretty close proximity of the bullets, but that was the only time that I actually felt that my life was in jeopardy. But the Iraqis greeted us with respect and dignity. And if you look in the Quran states that whenever your enemies come to you, then you treat them as your friends until they do something to harm you. And then once they do something to harm you, then they become your enemy. And, of course, you can retaliate. So it's very explicit in the Quran how they treat their so-called enemy.
Mm-hmm. Did you witness this transformation then? Would you say that we did incur harm and that the general sentiment of the Iraqi people had changed?
Yes. And this happened from the checkpoints that we were manning. How do you tell a 25-year-old young Iraqi male, don't pick up an RPG, after he just witnessed his little sister or his brother being brutally murdered by U.S. Marines? How do you try to, you know, influence that young man not to persuade him not to pick up an RPG? So it's almost kind of like a double-edged sword. We're setting ourselves up for failure, mm-hmm. Ultimately within this country.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, what was the general sentiment among your colleagues? This obviously caused you a great deal of personal turmoil. It has also, I think, invested you with a great deal of courage to speak out about this, and I'm sure many of us thank you. But what was the response from many of your colleagues, many of the soldiers who you were toured with?
I think more on the lines of what they have a problem with ingesting is the fact that I broke the code of silence, the muerta. this code of silence, you basically take two oaths whenever you enlist into the Marine Corps. You take the oath of enlistment, of course, and then the second one is a secret one. It's the one that the code of silence. And that code of silence is whatever happens on the battlefield stays on the battlefield. Whatever happens overseas stays overseas. So when I broke that code of silence, that kind of labeled me as a traitor. So I would say I'm viewed by my colleagues with my 12 years of experience in the Marine Corps. I'm viewed by my colleagues as a traitor, a turncoat, or whatnot.
Right. Was that just as troubling when you made your decision to leave the Army? Was that just as troubling than what you had experienced and what you were involved with in Iraq?
You know, when you go to bed at night and you have you're laying there and you got your head on the pillow and you close your eyes, if you can't come to a clear conscience, if you can't look back and reflect on the day, did I do something positive? Did I do something constructive towards humanity? If you can't do that, then are you being productive? And I ask myself that every night before I go to bed. But I started having haunting nightmares and dreams about all the ill humanity that I did to mankind, such as lying, cheating, while I was a recruiter, beg, borrow, stealing. I did whatever I had to do to make mission as a recruiter. And then I turned right around from recruiting duty and went on to the battlefield where I killed innocent civilians. So I can no longer sleep at night. The only way for me to, I feel the only way for me to recover from this is to voice my opinion and to speak the truth about what I saw in Iraq and what's going on.
Right. Well, thank you again for doing that. I was going to wait to London to bring this up, but I just thought since we kind of mentioned something about it, I'd like to share this with you. We actually had an Art of War exhibit recently. A group of local citizens had coordinated an event on this last Friday, and it involved posters, images of war that are often not seen. The response was overwhelmingly positive, except for one gentleman. And he has a son over in Iraq, and I can understand his anger. How do you speak to families who have sons over there, or daughters, or fathers or mothers?
It's tough. Just even at this last event that I was at, you feel... You can feel the tension, and I know I have a son. You can feel the tension between parents. It's a different type of tension. It's almost kind of like helplessness, and you want to do everything that you can for that person and try to comfort them and to tell them, that everything's going to be okay. But they know the realities of war, and they know what the consequences of war. What it is, and a lot of times people will try to cover that up. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to feel that emotion. They don't want to feel that anger. So they repress it. And whenever an image comes out about the war and it's in a negative light, then they try to chastise. They try to desensitize it or whatnot and sterilize it so that it fits in their world. Mm-hmm. However, it doesn't work like that. Unfortunately, these are horrors and horrors of war and the realities of war. And it's something that if our country is willing to commit to because of the weapons of mass destruction, then we should be willing to commit to showing the atrocities and the horrors that come about with war.
Right, right. I have another question I'd like to ask then. You mentioned something about almost like a personal reflection that is required by people on a daily basis. Were you constructive? Were you productive today? So I could understand if somebody was a parent of a son over there, it's almost as if you are saying, you're not thinking about this. You're committing something horrible that you're not thinking about. I know that's not your indictment. Who do you hold responsible? And do you think that soldiers should be accountable to any degree?
Sure. That's great. I'm glad you brought that up. I do think that soldiers should be held accountable, and I think that I should be held accountable for my actions. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing, why I'm speaking out and trying to spread the word about the truth about what is going on in Iraq. A lot of people think that I have alternate motives. I have written a book. The name of the book is Cowboys from Hell. I got asked at the last conference the last meeting that we just came from over at the community college. They said somebody stood up and they said, "Oh, you're just here for the money. You're just here promoting your book or whatnot." Well, the book hasn't even been published yet, so I'm not here promoting the book. I do read passages every now and then out of the book. But what I plan on doing with the money is starting which I've already started, a PTSD fund, post-traumatic stress disorder fund for returning soldiers in Western North Carolina. Because the support group, that's where I think we fail. We don't mention the support that these soldiers and returning Marines are going to have once they come home. Because when you start dealing with that self-destructive behavior, what do? That becomes the very hard part. And that's what these families are going to come home to. They're going to come home to members that it may take a while. PTSD, post-traumatic stress, can linger or come as quickly as 6 days, or it could manifest or it takes over 35 years, just depending on the individual. So we need to take these individuals and bring them into our community and let them know that they're here and we're going to take care of them.
Okay. I'd like to continue talking about that right after. We're just going to take about a 30-second break. Again, if you're interested, we might be able to field some calls at the end. The number here is 607-777-2137. You're listening to Civil Discourse, and I'm talking with Sergeant Jimmy Massey. Okay, this is Civil Discourse. Again, if you're just joining us, we're talking with Sergeant Jimmy Massey, former Marine Staff Sergeant who was honorably discharged in December 2003 after having served 12 years. You were just speaking about how very admirably you were going to use any funds that would come from your book to start a post-traumatic stress disorder clinic.
Yes,
facility. I was just looking at some statistics, and it says of the 244,000 veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars already discharged from service, 48,733 sought treatment at VA facilities last year. That's 1 in 6. Now, this is a difficult subject, but I was wondering if you could share with us some of your personal experiences. This is, it's not a wound that you can see, but it's just as damaging. If you might be able to share some of that, I would appreciate that.
Yeah, PTSD, it's kind of the only way that I can explain is maybe having a untreatable cancer or, a condition that just progressively gets worse or subsides for a little while, but still there. It's kind of like that little pimple that you have on your side of your cheek. It's there, you keep popping it, but it comes back or whatnot. I know that was a silly cliche, but that's the only way that I can describe it. And the hard part is the nightmares and the flashbacks. The flashbacks can come at any time. I have to really be careful while I'm driving or operating any type of machinery or anything like that, because I'll be sitting at a red light and I'll hear screeching tires, and I'll have a flashback right there, and I'll literally traject myself back into the situation in Iraq. My wife, she has to walk around with pins and needles. She has to be careful not to startle me or anything like that. So living with you know, PTSD, it's very difficult. You have to learn how to change your entire lifestyle and change your motives and how you feel about life, because one single little problem that you might have can manifest twofold within a matter of seconds. So you have to be able to realize to I do what's called reality check. When I have these PTSD moments, I tell myself, okay, where am I? What am I doing?
Right.
Why am I here? And if I don't, I'll literally drift off.
Hmm.
And so it's a very debilitating. The medication that they had me on, four different types of antidepressants and an antipsychotic. I'm 33 years old, and I've been diagnosed 80% disabled by the Veterans Administration. I'm currently under reevaluation for 100% disability. I can't work. This is my job. This is my job. I find that this is the best therapy or healing that I can go through, is just talking about it. But PTSD, the hardest with the flashbacks and the nightmares.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to hear this, but again, thank you. I think in effect we're all healing somewhat when you share this with us. I'd like to talk not only, I know that there's a large support structure growing, not just to deal with the psychological trauma for troops returning home, but also within the veterans. The veterans understand this, and I know soldiers that have been over in Iraq, there are already two groups. I believe it was Iraq Veterans Against the War and
yes.
Operation Truth as
yes.
well. You don't see any of this in the media.
No.
Have you been able to talk in any major media outlets? Have you tried to solicit responses?
Yeah, especially with IVAW. I'm a co-founder of the IVAW.
Oh, great.
And, and thank you for the recognition.
Sure.
We take the recognition anytime that we can get it. But it's a slow process, because the media, if they don't feel that it's important, then they're not going to air it. So the formation of a group, you know, Iraqi Veterans Against the War, is not, in their eyes, earth-shaking, groundbreaking material. So they really limit, you know, the publicity and what we do.
I know there's going to be there's a large global day of protest scheduled for March 19th. I also know that at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, there's going to be a very large protest event scheduled there, much of it coordinated by military families.
Yes.
Are you going to be involved in this day of protest, and where might you be?
Yes. I don't know where I'll be, but I will be there.
You're always welcome to come here.
Yeah. I'm going to be in Fayetteville. Mm-hmm. During that time, and I have some public speaking engagements that are lined up while I'm there, and we're just hoping to get out there and spread the word and have a good time.
Good.
It's going to be great.
Good. One other thing, then, we're getting close to the end of our show, so I'd just like to ask you, the anti-war group and the coalitions that have been building, it's a mixed bag. I mean, the demographics, you have your peace advocates, you have those who think that there are just wars, but that Iraq war was absolutely not to be conflated with our war on terrorism. There are those who look at war in the context of economic imperialism. So there's a wide range of voices. I'm curious, if the troops were to come home tomorrow, would you be done talking?
That's a good question.
I guess another way to ask you is, do you question, since you've first had dealt with a very difficult challenge to question this war, have you deepened that inquiry? You've mentioned that the oil bases were some of the first things that you had, that they had protected. So there is this question that begs of economics, of geopolitical strategy. Have you continued that inquiry? And if the troops again were to come home, then would you find that there would be little to talk about?
No. I think that the next goal that I would accomplish is the economic conscript. It's a slow process. We have a problem within the United States with the economic conscript, where we're forcing young men and women to go into the military. The recruiting practices that the United States Marine Corps utilizes are, first of all, they're unethical. I know this. I was a recruiter for 3 years. I lied, cheated, begged, borrowed, and stole, did what I had to do to make it successfully off of recruiting duty. But I think that I would still be speaking out until as long as there is a military, as long as there is a Marine Corps, then I'll be around.
Great. And then I suppose, do you have any final thoughts? If you had a room full of high school students, just to very quickly perhaps end on this subject, now with the No Child Left Behind Act, there was a very quiet corollary stipulation that all public schools who receive federal funds must allow military recruiters access to their school at least 4 times a year, perhaps more. Also, all students' personal information can then be given to the military. So if you had a room full of high school students, now that they see the presence of the Army, the Marines, they're getting, you know, calendars, periodic tables, what would you say to them?
I will tell them, don't fall into the trap. This morning, right across from Binghamton High School, I saw a Marine Corps recruiter dressed in fatigues driving a Corvette. What type of message do you think that sends to the students?
That's incredible.
I like to fell over. But however, I had to applaud him at the same time, because that's the same technique that I used to use. Materialism, vanity, tangibles. I think that's what we need to explain to the young men and women, especially at the high school level, is that this money, materialistic, the tangible benefits in life are not going to get you very far. But what the recruiter is going to do is he's going to try to teach you about the intangibles in life, the self-confidence, self-discipline, self-respect, so on. And he's going to play on that. He's going to play on their feelings and their emotions, and utilize that to get them to sign up to go into the Marine Corps. Bottom line is, you need self-discipline to pull a trigger. You need self-confidence to kill another human being. You need self-respect to blow another person up. That's how the Marine Corps utilizes these intangible traits. So if you're willing to commit yourself to those type of intangible traits and you want to live your life like that, then join the Marines, by all means. And then you can drive around in front of the high school with a Corvette.
Jimmy Massey, I just want to say thank you so much again. It's an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And again, Jimmy will be joining, we'll have a final assembly this evening, Binghamton University at 7 p.m. at Lecture Hall 1. I'm getting a message from my engineer that we have a call. I thought we were running out of time, but let's patch it through for one call.
Well, actually, she didn't want to be on the air, but she did have a question. She said you are a veteran for 12 years, or you're in the Marines for 12 years. How did you feel before going to Iraq?
The question was, how did I feel about going to Iraq before Iraq? Is right? Okay. I was just like everybody else. I actually believed in the weapons of mass deception. I mean, destruction. I believed in that, and I you know, through all the intelligence and the propaganda that I had been fed throughout the years being in the Marine Corps, I believe that Saddam Hussein had that capability. So when we got in country and we didn't find anything and we met no resistance or little to no resistance on the way up, I began to really question what was going on and what we were truly there for.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thanks to the caller for that call. Next week, I don't know exactly what the show will be on, but you guys, as always, you could check the website, www.modocpress.com. This show will also be archived there, so if anybody would like to pass word to their friends, if you have high school students, please go to the website, listen to what Jimmy Massey has to share with you, and again, if you could join us this evening, that'd be wonderful. This Massey's coming here to the community as part of a larger series of events. The Binghamton Independent Media Center will have a winter film festival next Saturday, March 12th. Or that's this Saturday, excuse me, Dissidents in War. They'll be featuring two features in a short, Miami Model, Independent Media in a Time of War, which is a wonderful short production between Democracy Now! And Independent Media Center Hudson Mohawk, and The Oil Factor. Again, I'd like to thank those for listening. I just have a final thing that I'd like to say. This is a New York Times article. United States officials were surprised and heartened today at the size of the turnout in elections, despite a terrorist campaign to disrupt the voting. According to reports from Saigon, 83% of the 5.85 million registered voters cast their ballots yesterday. Many of them risked reprisals threatened by the Viet Cong. Yes, that was Saigon and Viet Cong. The article was written September 3, 1967. This successful election was seen as the keystone in President Johnson's policy to ensure freedom was on the march. Sadly, the joys over that 1967 election were short-lived. We all know what happened. U.S. troops remained for another 8 years, resulting in the death of 50,000 American men and women and 3 million Vietnamese. So please join us on March 19th, Global Day of Protest. And again, thank you, Jimmy, for coming into Civil Discourse.
Thank you.
We're going to conclude the show with a original piece from Great Stone Sound System. This is Civil Discourse. Taco Delzim signing off.